learn fast, and get to try again fast. That leads to growth and future success. Number 7. Stop looking for the right answer. Because of my personality type, I'm someone who is always looking for options. However, I know that there are many people with different personality types who are motivated to find the right answer to any question. Believe it or not, that is a problem. These single-solution people are not putting themselves in the best situation to learn and grow. Why? Because there is always more than one solution to a problem. If you believe there is only a single right solution, you either get frustrated because you can't find it, or if you think you have found it, you stop searching and perhaps miss better ideas. In addition, when you land on what you consider to be the right answer, you become complacent. No idea is perfect. No matter how good it is, it can always be improved. You've probably heard the expression, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. That phrase definitely was not coined by someone dedicated to personal growth. If that has been your mindset in the past, then I suggest you develop a questioner's mindset instead and replace the popular phrase with the following question. If it ain't broke, how can we make it better? If it ain't broke, when is it likely to break in the future? If it ain't broke, how long will it serve as the world changes? People with curiosity keep asking questions, and as a result, they keep learning. Several years ago, I sold my company so I could focus my energy and spend more time writing and speaking. But after a while, I became frustrated. I could see that the resources I had developed over many years to help others grow, develop, and learn leadership weren't reaching the people the way I thought they could. So in 2011, I bought them back and started the John Maxwell Company so I could direct that process again. I am so excited because I love my team. It's small, fast, focused, and highly talented. I put everything in their hands and turn them loose to make things happen. And I've told them that I want them to come to work every morning, convinced that there is a better way of doing everything they do, determined to find out who can help them learn to do it, and ready to make things better than they've ever been. And they're doing it. Roger Von Eck, author of A Whack on the Side of the Head, says, almost every advance in art, cooking, medicine, agriculture, engineering, marketing, politics, education, and design has occurred when someone challenged the rules and tried another approach. If you want to avoid growing too comfortable and becoming stagnant, then keep asking questions and challenging the process. Keep asking if there is a better way to do things. Will that annoy complacent and lazy people? Yes. Will it energize, challenge, and inspire growing people? Yes. Number 8, get over yourself. If you're going to ask questions and allow yourself to fail, then you will at times look foolish. Most people don't like that. Do you know what my response is? Get over yourself. As Roger Von Eck says, if we never tried anything that might make us look ridiculous, we'd still be in caves. Instead, we need to be more like children. The thing I love about young children is that they just ask. They don't worry if a question is foolish. They just ask it. They don't worry about whether they will look dumb trying something new. They just do it, and as a result, they learn. Richard Thalheimer, founder of the Sharper Image, says, it's better to look uninformed than to be uninformed. Curb your ego and keep asking questions. That's great advice. Number 9, get out of the box. I've always loved the quote by inventor Thomas Edison, there ain't no rules around here. We're trying to accomplish something. Edison was forever trying to innovate, to think outside the box. Most revolutionary ideas were disruptive violations of existing rules. They upset the old order. As Ralph Waldo Emerson said, all life is an experiment. The more experiments you make, the better. I value innovative thinking, and I'm easily frustrated by people who refuse to think outside of their self-imposed boxes. When people say things like, we've never done it that way before, or that's not my job, I just want to shake them up. I want to offer to do their funeral because they've already died and are obviously just waiting for somebody to make it official. good ideas are everywhere, but it's hard to see them when you won't look outside of your box. Instead of remaining confined, people need to break down the walls of their boxes, get out, and become hunters of ideas. That requires an abundance mindset. Unfortunately, most in-the-box thinkers possess a scarcity mindset. They don't think there are many resources to go around. They believe they can't. Author Brian Clemmer says, "One of the keys to abundance is having a solution-oriented mindset. The average person thinks of himself as positive, but he's not solution-oriented. In other words, most people live inside the box instead of outside of it. They live with their limitations." Clemmer observes, "When average people ask themselves, 'Can I do this?' they base it on the circumstances they see. An abundant thinker asks different questions. An abundant thinker asks, 'How can I?' This simple twist of semantics changes everything. It forces your mind to create a solution. The best way to make a sluggish mind active is to disturb its routine. Getting outside the box does that for a person." Number 10, enjoy your life. Perhaps the greatest way to remain curious and keep growing is to enjoy your life. Tom Peters, author of In Search of Excellence, observed, "The race will go to the curious, the slightly mad, and those with an unsatiated passion for learning and daredeviltry. I believe it honors God when we enjoy life and live it well. That means taking risk, sometimes failing, sometimes succeeding, but always learning." When you enjoy your life, the lines between work and play begin to blur. We do what we love, and we love what we do. Everything becomes a learning experience. Curiosity was his key. Would you say that someone who earned a Ph.D., was a professor at a prestigious university, and won a Nobel Prize for physics, had probably done a pretty good job of tapping into his potential? How about if you also learned that that person had been invited to help invent the first atomic bomb on the Manhattan Project when he was only in his 20s? That's a pretty strong resume, isn't it? What would be the key to such a person's success? Most people would guess intelligence. But this scientist was reputed to have an above-average IQ of only 125. Sure, he was intelligent, but the real secret to his growth and success was his insatiable curiosity. His name was Richard Feynman, the son of a uniform salesman from New York City. He was always encouraged to ask questions and think for himself. As a child of 11, he built electrical circuits and did experiments at home, and soon got a reputation for being able to fix radios. He was always exploring, learning, and asking why. He began learning algebra in elementary school. He mastered trigonometry and both differential and integral calculus by the age of 15. It was play for him. When his high school physics teacher became frustrated with him, he handed him a book saying, "You talk too much and you make too much noise. I know why. You're bored. Study this book, and when you know everything that's in this book, you can talk again." It was an advanced calculus book from a course for college seniors. Feynman devoured it. It became another tool in his toolbox for learning about the world. He had a lifelong love for solving puzzles and breaking codes. When he was in high school, his classmates knew this and threw at him every kind of puzzle, equation, geometry problem, or brain teaser that they could find. He solved them all. His curiosity knew no bounds. Feynman's desire to know why drove him to study anything and everything. He wasn't interested only in physics or mathematics. Any idea could spark his interest. For example, when he studied physics as an undergraduate at MIT, he took a summer job as a chemist. When he was at Princeton studying for his Ph.D., he would eat lunch with graduate students from other disciplines so he could learn what questions they were asking and what problems they were trying to solve. Because of that, he ended up taking his Ph.D.-level courses in philosophy and biology. That curiosity continued his entire life. One summer, he decided to do advanced work in genetics. Another time, on vacation in Guatemala, he taught himself how to read ancient Mayan writings, which led him to make significant mathematical and astronomical discoveries in an ancient manuscript. He became an expert on art, learned to draw, and became good enough to have a one-man show. He was a lifelong learner. Feynman did experience a brief period when his curiosity waned. It was after the exhausting and demanding years he spent on the Manhattan Project. He went through a kind of slump and believed that he had burned out. He lost the will to explore. But then he figured out what the problem was. Feynman wrote, "I used to enjoy doing physics. Why did I enjoy it? I used to play with it. It didn't have to do with whether it was important for the development of nuclear physics, but whether it was interesting and amusing or fun to play with. When I was in high school, I'd see water running out of a faucet growing narrower and wonder if I could figure out what determines that curve. I found it was rather easy to do. I didn't have to do it. It wasn't important for the future of science. Somebody else had already done it. That didn't make any difference. I'd invent things and play with things for my own entertainment. So I got this new attitude. Now that I'm burned out and I'll never accomplish anything, I'm going to play with physics whenever I want to without worrying about any importance whatsoever." That change in mindset enabled him to rekindle his curiosity and cure his burnout. As a result, he started to ask why again. Soon after this, he saw someone in the university cafeteria spin a plate by throwing it into the air. He wondered why the plate spun and wobbled the way it did. He figured it out mathematically and made some drawings just for fun. The diagrams and math he did while doing what he called piddling around with the wobbling plate are what led to his receiving the Nobel Prize for Physics. So he did end up doing things that were important to science. But that occurred simply because he wanted to know why for his own growth and satisfaction. Feynman lived the law of curiosity. Do you? To know the answer, ask yourself these 10 questions. Do you believe you can be curious? Do you have a beginner's mindset? Have you made why your favorite word? Do you spend time with curious people? Do you learn something new every day? Do you partake in the fruit of failure? Have you stopped looking for the right answer? Have you gotten over yourself? Do you get out of the box? Are you enjoying your life? If your answers are yes, then you probably are. If not, you need to change. And you can. Being able to answer yes to those questions has little to do with native intelligence, level of talent, or access to opportunities. It has everything to do with developing curiosity and a willingness to ask why. Writer and wit Dorothy Parker observed, "The cure for boredom is curiosity. There is no cure for curiosity." How true that is. When you're curious, the entire world opens up to you, and there are few limits on what you can learn and how you can develop. Applying the law of curiosity to your life. Number one. Think about the 3 to 5 major areas in your life where you focus most of your time and energy. How do you see yourself in each of those areas? Do you think of yourself as an expert or a beginner? If you see yourself as an expert, you may be in trouble when it comes to further growth. Beginners know that they have a lot to learn and are open to every possible idea. They are willing to think outside the box. They don't get hung up on preconceived notions. They are willing to try new things. If you have a beginner's mindset in an area, do everything you can to maintain it. If you've come to think of yourself as an expert, beware. Find a way to rekindle a learner's attitude. Find a mentor who is ahead of you in that area. Or do what Richard Feynman did. Look for the fun again. Number 2, make a list of the people you spend the most time with in a given week. Now rate each person on his or her level of curiosity. Are the majority of the people in your world questioners? Do they often ask why? Do they like to learn new things? If not, you need to make some intentional changes to spend time with more curious people. Number 3. One of the greatest obstacles to curiosity and learning is the reluctance to look foolish in the eyes of other people. There are 2 easy ways to tell if this is a potential problem in your life. The first is being afraid to fail. The second is taking yourself too seriously. The cure is to take what I call learning risks. Sign up to do or learn something that takes you completely out of your comfort zone. take an art class, sign up for dance lessons, study a martial art, learn a foreign language. Find a master at calligraphy or bonsai to train you. Just be certain to pick something that you find fun, where you cannot be seen as an expert, and that is far out of your comfort zone. Chapter 13, The Law of Modeling. It's hard to improve when you have no one but yourself to follow. The most important personal growth phrase you will ever hear a good leader say to you is, follow me. In the Law of Intentionality chapter, I explained how in 1972, I searched unsuccessfully for people who had growth plans to help me learn how to develop my own. That prompted me to buy the kit that Kirk Kampmeyer offered and started me on the path of intentional personal growth. That provided a great start for me, but I have to admit that my early development process was hit and miss. I was learning according to trial and error. On the positive side, personal growth became my number one priority. I was learning how to choose books to read, lessons to listen to, and conferences to attend. At first, I took a scattershot approach. I grabbed hold of anything that appealed to me, but I wasn't getting the traction I had hoped for. Then I figured out that I needed to focus my growth on the areas of my personal strength, leadership, relationships, and communication. When I did that, my effectiveness in growth started to increase. I also started to learn how to glean from what I was studying. Resources have little value unless you can pull from them the essentials that you need. That meant learning to take useful notes, gathering quotes, and reflecting on what I was learning. I often summarized what I learned and wrote action points inside the front cover of a book that was significant to me. And it meant collecting, categorizing, and filing stories and quotes every day. I also put into practice anything I learned at my earliest opportunity. All of these practices became part of my daily discipline and have continued to be part of it for the last 40 years. My car became my classroom as I listened to tapes and later CDs. The desk in my study always had a stack of books that I was working through. My files were continually growing. I was growing, my leadership was improving, and I was seeing better results professionally. On the negative side, I came to a realization around this same time. Personal growth without the benefit of personal mentors could take me only so far. If I wanted to become the leader I desired to be and believed that God had created me to become, I needed to find models who were ahead of me to learn from. Why? Because it's hard to improve when you have no one else but yourself to follow. That's the lesson of the law of modeling. Whom should I follow? I have learned a lot from people I've never met. Dale Carnegie taught me people skills when I read How to Win Friends and Influence People in junior high school. James Allen helped me understand that my attitude and the way that I thought would impact the course of my life when I read As a Man Thinketh. And Oswald Sanders revealed the importance of leadership to me for the first time when I read his book Spiritual Leadership. Most people who decide to grow personally find their first mentors in the pages of books. That is a great place to start. For that matter, it's a great place to continue. I am still learning from dozens of people every year that I will never meet. But at some point, you must find personal models too. If you follow only yourself, you will find yourself going in circles. I've had the privilege of connecting with many leaders whose modeling I found worthy of imitation. People such as consultant Fred Smith, Speaker Zig Ziglar, and Coach John Wooden have helped me tremendously. Others who looked better from a distance than they actually were when I got to know them turned out to be disappointments, which just goes to show that you must be selective when it comes to choosing mentors and models. I smile every time I think of the two derelicts sunning themselves on a park bench. The first guy said, "The reason I'm here is because I refuse to listen to anyone." The second guy responded, "The reason I'm here is because I listen to everyone." Neither course of action is helpful. You must be selective in who you choose as a mentor. From both the positive and the negative experiences I've had with mentors, I have developed criteria to determine the worthiness of a model for me to follow. I share them with you in the hope that they will help you to make good choices for this area of your growth. Number one, A good mentor is a worthy example. We become like the people we admire and the models we follow. For that reason, we should take great care when determining which people we ask to mentor us. They must not only display professional excellence and possess skill sets from which we can learn, they must also demonstrate character worthy of emulating. Many athletes, celebrities, politicians, and business leaders today try to disavow being any kind of a role model when others are already following them and mimicking their behavior. They want people to separate their personal behavior from their professional life. But such a division cannot really be made. Religious leader and author Gordon B. Hinckley advised, "It is not wise or even possible to divorce private behavior from public leadership, though there are those who have gone to great lengths to suggest that this is the only possible view of enlightened individuals. They are wrong. They are deceived. By its very nature, true leadership carries with it the burden of being an example. Is it asking too much of any public officer elected by his or her constituents to stand tall and be a model before the people, not only in the ordinary aspects of leadership, but in his or her behavior? If values aren't established and adhered to at the top, behavior down the ranks is seriously jeopardized and undermined. Indeed, in any organization where such is the case, be it a family, a corporation, a society, or a nation, the values being neglected will in time disappear. As you look for role models and mentors, scrutinize their personal lives as carefully as their public performance. Your values will be influenced by theirs, so you shouldn't be too casual who you choose to follow. Number 2, a good mentor is available. Steel magnate and philanthropist Andrew Carnegie said, "As I grow older, I pay less attention to what men say. I just watch what they do." For us to be able to observe models up close and see what they do, we must have some contact with them. That requires access and availability. For us to be actively mentored, we must have time with people to ask questions and learn from their answers. When I mentor people, we usually meet officially only a few times a year. However, during the year, we sometimes spend time together informally. Many of their mentoring questions are stimulated by my actions, not my words. That thought humbles me because I know at times I fall short of the ideals and values that I teach. As I have often said, my greatest leadership challenge is leading me. Teaching people what to do is easy. Showing them is much more difficult. The greatest piece of advice I can give in this area of availability is that when you are looking for a mentor, don't shoot too high too soon. If you're considering going into politics for the first time, you don't need the advice of the President of the United States. If you're a high school student thinking about learning to play the cello, you don't need to be mentored by Yo-Yo Ma. If you're fresh out of school and just starting your career, don't expect to get extensive mentoring time from the CEO of your organization. Why shouldn't I, you may be thinking? Why not start with the best? First of all, if you're just starting out, nearly all your questions can be answered by someone 2 or 3 levels ahead of you, not 10. And their answers will be fresh because they will have recently dealt with the issues you're dealing with. Second, CEOs need to be spending their time answering the questions of the people who are on the verge of leading at their level. I'm not saying you should never go to the top. I'm saying spend the majority of your time being mentored by people who are available, willing, and suited for the stage of your career. And as you progress in your development, find new mentors for your new level of growth. Number 3, a good mentor has proven experience. The farther you go in the pursuit of your potential, the more new ground you will have to break. How do you figure out how to proceed? Benefit from others' experience. As the Chinese proverb says, to know the road ahead, ask those coming back. In the early 1970s, when my church was growing rapidly, I realized I was moving into territory that I hadn't been in before, nor had anyone I knew. To help me figure out how to lead better in this new territory, I began to seek out successful church leaders in larger churches around the country. I've told the story many times of how I offered $100 to them for 30 minutes of their time. Many graciously agreed to meet with me. I'd go to the meeting armed with a legal pad full of questions and pick their brains. I can hardly explain how much I learned in those sessions. Every time I've entered into a new venture, I've sought the advice of people with proven experience. When I started my first business, I talked to successful business people who could give me advice. When I wanted to write my first book, I sat at the feet of successful authors who could guide me. To learn to communicate more effectively, I studied communicators. Hearing about their bad experiences made me aware of potential problems I would be facing up the road. Hearing about their good experiences gave me an anticipation of potential opportunities up ahead of me. I don't know of a successful person who hasn't learned from more experienced people. Sometimes they follow in their footsteps. Other times they use their advice to help them break new ground. Former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani says, "All leaders are influenced by those they admire. Reading about them and studying their traits inevitably allows an inspiring leader to develop his own leadership traits." Number 4, a good mentor possesses wisdom. There's a well-known story of an expert who was called by a company to look at their manufacturing system. It had broken and everything was at a standstill. When the expert arrived, he carried nothing but a little black bag. Silently, he walked around the equipment for a few minutes and then he stopped. As he focused on one specific area of the equipment, he pulled a small hammer out of his bag and he tapped it gently. Suddenly, everything began running again and he quietly left. The next day, he set a bill that made the manager go ballistic. It was for $1,000. Quickly, the manager emailed the expert and wrote, "I will not pay this outrageous bill without it being itemized and explained." Soon he received an invoice with the following words: "For the tapping on equipment with hammer, $1. For knowing where to tap, $999. That is the value of wisdom. Mentors with wisdom often show us where to tap. Their understanding, experience, and knowledge help us to solve problems that we would have a hard time handling on our own. Fred Smith was a mentor who often deposited wisdom into my life. One day I asked him why highly successful people often sabotage their lives and hurt their careers. He said, "Never confuse the giftedness of a person with a person. Their gifts allow them to do amazing things, but the person may be flawed, which will eventually cause harm." That bit of wisdom has helped me immeasurably. First, it has helped me to better understand how to work with talented people and to help them develop. Second, it has been a caution to me personally. I know that having talent in a given area never exempts me from neglecting discipline or character issues. We're all just one step away from stupid. Wise people often use just a few words to help us to learn and develop. They open our eyes to worlds we might not have otherwise seen without their help. They help us navigate difficult situations. They help us see opportunities we would otherwise miss. They make us wiser than our years and experience. Number 5. A good mentor provides friendship and support. The first question most followers ask of a mentor is, "Do you care for me?" The reason for this question is obvious. Who wants to be guided by a person who isn't interested in them? Selfish people will assist you only insofar as it advances their own agenda. Good mentors provide friendship and support, unselfishly working to help you reach your potential. Their mindset is well expressed by business coach and author James S. Fuocolo, who says, "Great things happen whenever we stop seeing ourselves as God's gift to others and begin seeing others as God's gift to us." One evening, I was enjoying dinner with the former CEO of Girl Scouts, Frances Hesselbein, and author Jim Collins. Both were mentored by Peter Drucker, often called the father of modern management. I had met Drucker and learned from him, but they had enjoyed a long-term relationship with him and had known him well. I asked them what they had learned from him, and their responses focused on the friendship of the man more than the wisdom of the expert. What Jim Collins told me that night is expressed very succinctly in an article he wrote after Drucker's death. "But for me, Drucker's most important lessons cannot be found in any text or lecture, but in the example of his life. I made a personal pilgrimage to Claremont, California in 1994, seeking wisdom from the greatest management thinker of our age. And I came away feeling that I had met a compassionate and generous human being who, almost as a side benefit, was a prolific genius. We have lost not a guru on a pedestal, but a beloved professor who welcomed students into his modest home for warm and stimulating conversation. Peter F. Drucker was driven not by the desire to say something, but the desire to learn something from every student he met. And that is why he became one of the most influential teachers most of us have ever known. If the person who offers to mentor you doesn't really support you and offer you friendship, then the relationship will always fall short of your expectations. Knowledge without support is sterile. Advice without friendship feels cold. Candor without care is harsh. However, when you are being helped by someone who cares for you, it is emotionally satisfying. Growth comes from both the head and the heart. Only supportive people are willing to share both with you. Number 6. A good mentor is a coach who makes a difference in people's lives. A major theme in my life is the desire to add value to people and make a difference in their lives. One of the ways I do this is by mentoring people. But my time is so limited that I can mentor only a few. That has caused frustration for me and for the many people who ask me to coach them or to train them to coach others. To my delight, I finally have a solution to this problem. In 2011, some friends helped me to create a coaching company called the John Maxwell Team. It has become one of my most fulfilling Make a Difference commitments because it enables me to add value to many people by helping to train and certify coaches who teach my principles. Together, we are making a difference in people's lives. I love the word coach. I read in my friend Kevin Hall's book Aspire that the word derives from the horse-drawn coaches that were developed in the town of Coach during the 15th century. The vehicles were originally used to transport royalty, but in time, they also carried valuables, mail, and common passengers. As Kevin remarks, a coach remains something or someone who carries a valued person from where they are to where they want to be. So if you had a coach, you knew you would end up at your desired destination. In a piece called A Coach by Any Other Name, Kevin goes on to describe what it means to be a coach. He writes, "In other cultures and languages, coaches are known by many different names and titles. In Japan, a sensei is one who has gone further down the path. In martial arts, it's the designation for master. In Sanskrit, a guru is one with great knowledge and wisdom. Gu means darkness and ru means light. A guru takes someone from darkness into the light. In Tibet, a lama is one with spirituality and authority to teach. In Tibetan Buddhism, a Dalai Lama is the highest ranking teacher. In Italy, a maestro is a master teacher of music. It is short for Maestro dei Cappella, meaning master of the chapel. In France, a tutor is a private teacher. The term dates to the 14th century and refers to one who served as a watchman. In England, a guide is one who knows and shows the way. It denotes the ability to see and point out the better course. In Greece, a mentor is a wise and trusted advisor. In the Odyssey, Homer's mentor was a protective and supportive counselor. All these words describe the same role. One who goes before and shows the way. No matter what word you use to describe them, coaches make a difference in others' lives. They help them grow. They improve their potential. They increase their productivity. They are essential to helping people affect positive change. As my friend Andy Stanley says in The Next Generation Leader, you will never maximize your potential in any area without coaching. It is impossible. You may be good, you may be even better than everyone else, but without outside input, you will never be as good as you could be. We all do better when somebody is watching and evaluating. Self-evaluation is helpful, but evaluation from someone else is essential. In my opinion, good coaches share five common characteristics. I have taken those five common characteristics, and each letter at the beginning of the sentence is one of the letters in the word coach. They care for the people they coach. They observe their attitudes, behavior, and performance. They align them with their strengths for peak performance. They communicate and give feedback about their performance. And they finally help them to improve their lives and performance. I have benefited from hundreds of people over the years who have modeled personal growth, mentored me from their successes, and coached me to better performance by using these five characteristics. I am indebted to them. The process of growing with the help of a mentor usually follows this pattern. It begins with awareness. You realize that you need help and that following yourself is not a viable option for effective personal growth. I was fortunate to come to this realization early in my career. I recognized that I had no experience, no exposure, and no strong models within my circles to help me develop my potential. When a person comes to such a realization, one of two things can happen. The first is that the person's pride swells up and he cannot bring himself to ask another person for advice. This is a common reaction. In his book, The Corporate Steeplechase, psychologist Shruley Blotnick says that people in their 20s starting their careers tend to be ashamed to ask questions. When they reach their 30s, their desire to be individualistic makes it difficult for them to seek counsel from colleagues. That can definitely work against them. To keep from looking ignorant, they almost ensure their own ignorance. The other reaction to awareness is to humble yourself and say, I need your help. That decision not only leads to greater knowledge, but it also often develops maturity. It reinforces that people need one another, not just when they're young and starting out, but their entire lives. As Chuck Swindoll also eloquently says in his book, The Finishing Touch, nobody is a whole chain. Each one is a link. But take away one link and the chain is broken. Nobody is a whole team. Each one is a player. But take away one player and the game is forfeited. Nobody is a whole orchestra. Each one is a musician. But take away one musician and the symphony is incomplete. You guessed it. We need each other. You need someone and someone needs you. Isolated islands we're not. To make this thing called life work, we gotta lean and support, and relate and respond, and give and take, and confess and forgive, and reach out and embrace, and release and rely. Since none of us is a whole independent, self-sufficient, super capable, all-powerful hotshot, let's quit acting like we are. Life's lonely enough without our playing this silly role. The game's over. Let's link up. As I look back over my life, I recognize that the greatest assets of my growth journey were people. But then again, so were the greatest liabilities. The people you follow, the models you emulate, the mentors you take advice from help to shape you. If you spend your time with people who subtract from you, who belittle you or undervalue you, then every step forward that you attempt to take will be difficult. But if you find wise leaders, good role models, and positive friends, you will find that they speed you on your journey. I've been fortunate to have many fantastic mentors during the course of my life. My first models were my parents, Melvin and Laura Maxwell. From them, I learned integrity and unconditional love. Elmer Towns and Zig Ziglar were two of the people I first learned from outside of the small circle I grew up in. Elmer was the first to teach me about growing my church. Zig was the first personal growth speaker I ever followed. Both became good friends. Tom Phillippe and my brother Larry Maxwell mentored me in business. Les Stobie helped me learn how to write my first book. Peter Drucker opened my eyes to the importance of developing people to the level where they could replace me. Fred Smith helped me to fine-tune my leadership skills. Bill Bright showed me the impact that business thinkers can have on the world of faith. John Wooden taught me how to be a better man. No matter who you are, what you have accomplished, how low or how high your life has taken you, you can benefit from having a mentor. If you've never had one, you have no idea how much it can improve your life. If you have had mentors, then you already know. And you should start passing it on by becoming a mentor to others because you know that it's hard to improve when you have no one but yourself to follow. Applying the law of modeling to your life. 1. Find a next step mentor. Think about where you are currently in your career and the direction you would like to go. Look for someone you admire who is 2 or 3 steps ahead of you on that same track. This person doesn't necessarily need to be in your organization. Look for the qualities needed in a good mentor. A worthy example, availability, proven experience, wisdom, willingness to be supportive, and coaching skills. If those are present in this individual, ask him or her to mentor you. Before any meeting with a mentor, come prepared with 3 to 5 thoughtful questions, the answers to which will help you significantly. After you've met, work to apply what you've learned to your own situation. Don't ask for another meeting until you have done that. At your next meeting, begin the session by telling your mentor how you applied what you learned, or how you tried to apply it and failed so you can learn what you did wrong. Then ask your new questions. Follow this pattern, and your mentor will be rewarded for his or her effort and will probably be glad to continue helping you. 2. We all need people who can help us sharpen specific strengths or navigate through certain problem areas. Who do you talk to when you have questions related to marriage, parenting, spiritual growth, personal disciplines, hobbies, and so on? No one person can answer all of these questions. You need to find several individual consultants to help you. Spend some time making 2 lists. First, list the specific strengths or skills that you want to improve to reach your potential. Second, list the specific problem areas where you feel the need for ongoing guidance. Begin looking for people with expertise in these particular areas and ask them if they would be willing to answer questions when you have them. 3. Do you have long-term models whom you can observe, follow, and learn from? People who can give you advice regarding the big picture of your life and career? Or are you trying to improve while having no one but yourself to follow? If you haven't been asking others to help you on your journey, it's time to start. Most of us begin by looking for worthy models to follow by reading about them in books. Start there, but don't leave it at that. Look for people who will give you access to their lives. One such person for me was John Wooden. For many decades, I learned from him from a distance. I watched his teams play on television. I followed his career. I read everything he wrote. However, when he was in his 90s, I had the privilege of meeting with him 2x a year for several years. I learned a lot from him, and I'm very grateful for the time I had with him. As you look for models and mentors, I want to give you a word of caution. Oftentimes, people look good from far away, but when you get to know them, you discover qualities you don't admire. If that happens to you, please don't allow it to discourage you. There are plenty of people out there who have integrity and who are worthy to be respected and followed, such as John Wooden. Keep looking for them, and you will find them. Chapter 14. The Law of Expansion. Growth always increases your capacity. There is no finish line, says the Nike commercial. Have you maxed out your capacity? Have you reached your full potential as a person? I believe that if you are listening to this, the answer is no. If you're still breathing and you are of sound mind, then you have the potential to keep increasing your capacity. In their book, If It Ain't Broke, Break It, authors Robert J. Kriegel and Lewis Patler write, "We don't have a clue as to what people's limits are. All the tests, stopwatches, and finish lines in the world can't measure human potential. When someone is pursuing their dream, they'll go far beyond what seems to be their limitations. The potential that exists within us is limitless and largely untapped. When you think of limits, you create them." How do you push toward your potential and keep increasing your capacity? I've spoken quite a bit about how to increase your effectiveness externally. You do that by including others and learning how to work with people. But the only way to increase your capacity internally is to change the way you approach personal growth. Learning more information isn't enough. You must change how you think, and you must change your actions. How to increase your thinking capacity. I've heard that most experts believe people typically use only 10% of their true potential. That statement is staggering. If that is true, then the average person has huge capacity for improvement. It's as if we possess hundreds of acres of possibilities, but keep only half an acre under cultivation. So how do we tap into the unused 90%? The answer is found in changing how we think and what we do. Let's start by looking at how you need to think to increase your capacity. Number one, stop thinking more work and start thinking what works. Ask most people how they can increase their capacity, and they'll tell you by working more. There's a problem with that solution. More work will not necessarily increase your capacity. More of the same usually results in more of the same, when what we actually want is better than what we have. I fell into this trap early in my career. In fact, when people began asking me how to help them be more successful, my answer to them was to work harder. I assumed that their work ethic wasn't as good as mine, and if they would just simply do more, they would be successful. However, I realized the error in my thinking when I started traveling to undeveloped countries where many people worked very hard but saw very little return for all of their efforts. I learned that hard work isn't always the answer. That prompted me to start looking at the way I approached my working life. Being a high-energy person, I worked hard and kept it up for long hours. But I knew that I wasn't as effective as I could be. I realized that the problem was that I valued effort over effectiveness. I was doing a lot of things instead of the right things. My to-do list kept getting longer, but my impact wasn't increasing. I realized that I had to change my thinking. I looked at everything I was doing and started to ask myself, what works? That's what I recommend you do. Figure out what works. To do that, ask yourself the following three questions. What am I required to do? What gives the greatest return? What gives me the greatest reward? These questions will help you to focus your attention on what you must do, what you ought to do, and what you really want to do. Number two, stop thinking, can I, and start thinking, how can I? At first glance, the questions can I and how can I may appear to be very similar. However, the reality is that they are worlds apart in terms of results. Can I is a question filled with hesitation and doubt. It is a question that imposes limitations. If that is the question you regularly ask yourself, you're undermining your efforts before you even begin. How many people could have accomplished much in life, but failed to try because they doubted and answered no to the question, can I? When you ask yourself, how can I, you give yourself a fighting chance to achieve something. The most common reason people don't overcome the odds is they don't challenge them enough. They don't test their limits. They don't push their capacity. How can I assumes there is a way. You just need to find it. As a young leader, I was challenged by the words of Robert Schuller, who said, what would you attempt if you knew you couldn't fail? To me, the answer was obvious, a lot more than I was currently attempting. Schuller's question prompted me to think outside the box. It made me want to take more risk, to push more boundaries, to test my own limits. It made me realize that most of our limitations are based not on lack of ability, but lack of belief. Sharon Wood, the first North American woman to climb Mount Everest, said of her experience, I discovered that it wasn't a matter of physical strength, but a matter of psychological strength. The conquest lay within my own mind to penetrate those barriers of self-imposed limitations and get to the good stuff, the stuff called potential, 90% of which we barely use. If you want to tap into the unused 90% ask, how can I? Do that, and greater achievement becomes a matter of when and how, not if. Recently, a friend gave me a book by Price Pritchett entitled, You. In it, Pritchett writes, your skepticism, which you presume is based on rational thinking and an objective assessment of factual data about yourself, is rooted in mental junk. Your doubts are not the product of accurate thinking, but habitual thinking. Years ago, you accepted flawed conclusions as correct, began to live your life as if those warped ideas about your potential were true, and ceased the bold experiment in living that brought you many breakthrough behaviors as a child. Now it's time for you to find that faith you had in yourself before. If you have spent time in a negative environment, or you have experienced abuse in your life, you may find this thinking transition to be very difficult. If that describes you, then let me take a moment to encourage you and explain something. I'm asking you to shift from can I to how can I, when maybe you need to change your thinking from I can't to how can I. I believe that if you've gotten this far in this audiobook, then deep down you already believe that you can achieve things. I believe you can too. I believe God has put in every person the potential to grow, expand, and achieve. The first step in doing that is believing that you can. I believe in you. The second is perseverance. As you get started, it may not look like you're making progress. That doesn't matter. Don't give up. Pritchett says that everything looks like a failure in the middle. He writes, you can't bake a cake without getting the kitchen messy. Halfway through surgery, it looks like there's been a murder in the operating room. If you send a rocket to the moon, about 90% of the time it's off course. It fails its way to the moon by continually making mistakes and then correcting them. You can change your thinking. You can believe in your potential. You can use failure as a resource to help you find the edge of your capacity. As psychiatrist Fritz Perls observed, learning is discovering that something is possible. The law of expansion is about learning, growing, increasing our capacity. It's said that one day the great artist Michelangelo went into the studio of Raphael. He looked at one of his early drawings, considered it a moment, then took a piece of chalk and wrote the word amplius, which means greater or larger, across the entire drawing. Michelangelo was encouraging Raphael to think bigger. That's what we need to do. Number three, stop thinking one door and start thinking many doors. When it comes to growth, you don't want to stake your future on one door. It may not open. It's much better to consider many possibilities and look for multiple answers to all of your questions. Think in terms of options. I made the mistake of looking for only one door early in my career. I wanted to build a great church, so I went looking for the key that would lead me to success. I started interviewing people to find someone who could give me the secret. It was almost like I was looking for someone who could grant me my wish. My thinking was all wrong. I wanted someone to give me a formula for my dream so I could act on it. In time, I came to realize that I needed to act on my dream and formulate the details as I made the journey. Mobility was critical to progress, and my strategy began to evolve out of my discovery process. One of my favorite words is options. Anyone who knows me well understands that I don't like being fenced in. But my desire for options is driven by more than just the desire to avoid mental claustrophobia. It's driven by the desire to increase my capacity. The more time goes by, the more I want to explore creative options and the less I want to rely on someone else's system. As I have learned to think many doors and explore options, here's what I've learned. There is more than one way to do something successfully. The odds of arriving anywhere increase with creativity and adaptability. Movement with intentionality creates possibilities. Failures and setbacks can be great tools for learning. Knowing the future is difficult, controlling the future is impossible. Knowing today is essential, controlling today is possible. Success is a result of continued action filled with continual adjustments. The greatest challenge you will ever face is that of expanding your mind. It's like crossing the great frontier. You must be willing to be a pioneer, to enter uncharted territory, to face the unknown, to conquer your own doubts and fears. But here's the good news. If you can change your thinking, you can change your life. As Oliver Wendell Holmes remarked, man's mind, once stretched by a new idea, never regains its original dimensions. If you want to expand your capacity, the first place to start is always in your own mind. How to increase your capacity for action. If you want to expand your potential and therefore your capacity, you must first change your thinking. However, if you change only your thinking and you neglect to change your actions, you will fall far short of your potential. To start expanding your capacity, take the following three steps. Number one, stop doing only those things you have done before and start doing those things you could and should do. The first step towards success is becoming good at what you know how to do. But the more that you do what you know, the more you discover additional worthy things you could do. When this occurs, you have a decision to make. Will you continue doing what you have always done, or will you make the leap and try new things? Doing new things leads to innovation and new discoveries, and among those discoveries is the realization of things you should do on a consistent basis. If you do those, you will continue to grow and expand your potential. If you don't, you will plateau. My friend Kevin Hall describes this process of discovery and growth in Aspire when he writes about a discussion he had with one of his mentors, retired professor Arthur Watkins. The gentleman was describing the growth of a tradesman from apprentice to master. Kevin recalls their conversation. A master didn't become a master overnight, he explained. There was a process. First, one must become an apprentice, then a journeyman, and then finally a master. Apprentice, journeyman, master. These three words illustrate the importance of going through fundamental and necessary steps to acquire the kind of humility that is commensurate with true leadership. Arthur grew quite animated, as if he were about to reveal an ancient truth. Do you know that apprentice means learner, he asked? Then taught that the word comes from the French apprendre, which means to learn. In earlier times, apprentice was the name for someone who would select a trade, then find a master in his village to teach him the skills necessary for his chosen vocation. After learning all he could from the local master, the apprentice would travel elsewhere to broaden his education. Launching forward on such a journey turned an apprentice into a journeyman. A journeyman would often travel long distances for the privilege of working under the master who could best help him further hone his craft. Over time, a journeyman could eventually become a master himself and be in a position to start the cycle all over again. The process of expanding one's potential is ongoing. It ebbs and flows. Opportunities come and go. The standards we must set for ourselves are constantly changing. What we could do changes as we develop. What we should do also evolves. We must leave behind some old things to take on new ones. It can be difficult work, but if we are willing, our lives are changed. In 1974, I became convinced that everything rises and falls on leadership. With that conviction came a passion for leading. I was fired up to learn how to lead effectively and then touch others. After several years, I achieved a level of comfort in my ability to lead others and teach on the subject. I was enjoying what I did and seeing a degree of success. But then I began to see opportunities, other things I could do. I had the chance to reach a larger audience. I was at a decision point. Should I enjoy my life or attempt to expand it? Expansion would mean leaving my comfort zone. I would have to start a business to produce teaching materials. I would have to develop people who could work alongside of me. I would have to learn to write books so I could reach people I'd never get to speak to. I would need to travel and learn the customs and cultures of those who lived in other countries to be able to communicate outside the United States. All these changes took time. I made a lot of mistakes. Often I was in over my head. Most days I felt like Pablo Picasso when he said, "I am always doing that which I cannot do in order to learn how to do it."